From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Horton Foote wrote the screenplays for To Kill a Mockingbird, Tender Mercies, and A Trip to Bountiful, all set in small southern towns. On this edition of Fresh Air, Horton Foote talks about the influence of his own hometown of Wharton, Texas. Also, tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette describes coming up through the ranks of the big bands in the 40s. Now he's leading his own big band, and he has his first new American recording in close to 20 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from big names in rhythm and blues, reggae, and blues. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Accused, starring Kelly McGillis as a prosecuting attorney and Jodie Foster as the victim of a brutal gang rape. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote won his first Academy Award in 1962 for his adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird. 21 years later, he won his second Academy Award for his screenplay Tender Mercies. Actress Geraldine Page received an Oscar for her performance in Foote's movie A Trip to Bountiful. Public television's American Playhouse has presented several of the plays in Foote's 9-part Orphan's Home cycle. Grove Press has just published a second volume of plays in the cycle. Horton Foote considers memory an unreliable thing, but much of his writing is based on his memories of growing up in the small town of Wharton, Texas. Fictionalized versions of that town have been the settings for most of his stories. A Trip to Bountiful was about an elderly woman who was forced to leave such a town when her son got a job in Houston. Her fantasy was to leave Houston and return to her old home in Bountiful, but when she summoned up the strength to leave her son, she found that Bountiful virtually no longer existed. The houses were boarded up. The day before she arrived, the last resident of Bountiful had died. All she could do was take one last look at her home.
That's all I want, just to see it, just to stand on the porch of my own house again.
Lady, I don't have anything
to... I thought last night that I had to stay. I thought I would just die if I couldn't stay. But now, I'll settle for less. An hour. Half an hour.
Horton Foote, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
And to start our interview, I'd actually like to ask you to read something from your new book of plays, something from the introduction that you wrote about change in your life.
All right, be happy to. Change was an early acquaintance in my life. My grandfather, who seemed impervious to all mortal ends, died when I was 9. And the reverberations and changes from that death continued for many years. It was soon after that I was to see a quiet, serene street in front of my grandparents' house begin its slow but steady descent into a metaphor for all the ugly, trashy highways that scar a great deal of small-town America. And these plays, I feel, are about change, unexpected, unasked for, unwanted, but to be faced and dealt with, or else we sink into despair or a hopeless longing for a life that's gone.
Well, I think that theme of change is not only apparent in the cycle of plays that has just been published, but also it's apparent in several of your movies, such as A Trip to Bountiful. And I'm wondering what kind of changes you've had to deal with in your life that has made the idea of coping with change such a potent one in your writing.
Well, I think anybody has to deal with change because life is constantly changing, and the perceptions that you have that you try to hold on to when you're young, so many things. I mean, people move away, and houses are sold, and people die, and new life comes into focus, and there are cycles of drought and cycles of too much rain. There is the unexpected is always there, and I think you really have to kind of find yourself not thrown by this and to take life as it is, each moment as best you can.
A Trip to Bountiful is about trying to return to the past and realizing that the past is always out of reach and that you can't really get back there. And you write in the introduction to your new plays that your first memory was of stories about the past.
Yes.
But that it didn't take you long for you to learn that the past was gone and nothing could be done about it. And I wonder if there was a turning point in your realization of that, just as there was for the character in A Trip to Bountiful.
Well, I learned that lesson very early because I was raised on stories of I'm a Southerner, and my family have been in the area that I was born in for many, many years. And as I was growing up, I was told of all the things that the family had had and were lost and never to be gotten back. And so I soon learned that you had to give that up. I mean, so many of my family spent their lives in regretting that and being defeated by it. But I soon learned that that's death.
Do you ever feel that some of your plays are misunderstood and that people think that your plays are about returning to the past instead of learning to give it up?
They think they're nostalgic, and they're not at all. I have a certain desire to be fair to the past and as exact as I can be about the past, even a past that I've only heard about orally and haven't really lived through, because so many of my plays are based on stories that were passed down to me by other people. I certainly think there are certain values in the past that we would be foolish to ignore and not to cherish and not to try to learn from. But I have no desire. I was thinking this morning, every day you read, what a terrible age we live in. Well, I've heard that all my life.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think any age is really any worse. They're just new problems, is all, and different problems.
You know, I have to ask you one thing about Geraldine Page's performance in the film A Trip to Bountiful. She won an Academy Award for her performance in that. She acts very girlish, although she's an old woman in it. But she has these girlish, almost flirtatious mannerisms.
Like a coquette.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you scripted that in, if that was part of your stage directions.
No. I don't do that for actors or actresses. Actually, you know, the part was originally created by Lillian Gish almost 30 years ago now. And, you can't imagine two more different talents than Lillian Gish or Geraldine Page. And both in their own way were extraordinary in the part. And I learned a great lesson from that. It's like if you have two great virtuosos, two violinists, you know, playing your music, you just are grateful for the differences. You don't try to make them the same. And I never do that for an actress.
Playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote is my guest, and he's won two Academy Awards for his screenplays, for Tender Mercies and also for To Kill a Mockingbird, plus he wrote A Trip to Bountiful. Now, describe the place in Texas where you grew up, the place that was home to you when you were young.
Well, it's still home. I still have a house there, and I've been there for since Christmas. I just came back here about 2 weeks ago.
Here being New York.
New York, yes. Well, when I grew up, it was about 3,500, and I suppose over half of those were blacks. Mm-hmm. And now it's maybe a town of about 10,000 and a little bit more suburban. The town itself, what we knew as the town, it's like all least southern towns that I know, is disappearing, and there are shopping malls creeping out into the country. And, you know, houses are torn down, and
it's great. This is the exact opposite of what happens to the character in A Trip to Bountiful. She goes home and finds out that home doesn't exist anymore. It's become a ghost town.
That's right.
You go home, and there's shopping malls all
over. That's right. It's in that transformation that's going on all over America.
Now, a lot of people, once they become teenagers, are very restless and want to get away from home, especially if they've been brought up in a small town. But I think even a lot of people in big cities, they just want to make a break and start a new life for themselves as an adult. Did you go through a period of restlessness where, as absorbed as you are with your hometown now, did you want to go through a period of wanting to get away?
Not so much getting away from my hometown, but simply for a pragmatic reason. I wanted to be an actor.
Oh.
And I knew I couldn't be.
This is before you started writing.
That's right. I knew there was no future in that in Wharton, except, you know, the little theater, and that I had exhausted that. So, you know, there was no place to go for me unless, you know, I wanted to do something and had no idea I wanted to write. And perhaps just as well, because I think that my writing is helped by distance. In other words, I don't write too much about my town or my people when I'm there. I'm too busy looking and watching and listening. And really, I do most of my writing. I keep journals and I work on other things, you know. But I do most of my writing of my plays when there's some distance between us.
Now, you bought the house that you grew up in, right?
That's right.
Who lives in it now?
I do.
I see. So when you go home, you're literally going home.
That's right. Yes, I'm going home. That's right. I not only bought that house, but I just bought the house next door. Because the house I grew up in it has very large rooms, but like a lot of Southern houses, it only had two bedrooms. And I have four children, so if I wanted to entice my children down there, I had to get more space.
I understand. Let's talk about Tender Mercies, the screenplay that you won an Academy Award for a few years ago. Now, Robert Duvall starred as a country and western songwriter and singer whose career derails because of alcoholism. And as he's trying to get sober, he falls in love with a young, very humble widow and moves in with her and her son. Why don't we hear a clip from that movie?
I don't know if I was what you call rich, but I had a few dollars.
How'd you get it?
Writing songs.
And how'd you get money for that?
Well, people are crazy enough to pay you for it. They do it.
What happened to your money?
I lost it.
How?
How? Too much applejack.
You think you'll ever be rich again?
Well, I'll tell you what, Sonny, I don't lay awake nights worrying about it. Now look, there's a D, right? D is in dog. Now watch me. I'll call him out. I've decided to leave G here forever. Not really. Let me know if you're staying behind. It's A7.
What did you relate to about that character that you created for Tender Mercies?
I'd known, actually, I kind of model, I model all my characters really in on. I take aspects of different people and kind of create a whole new person. And I really took as my model people I'd known in the theater. I didn't really know a lot about country western singing or singers. And but I had known many people in the theater who were stars or near stars who had been defeated in some measure by alcoholism, and once in a while they'd defeated that and found a way to continue. So that really was kind of in my mind all the time I was creating Max Sledge.
Now, you had a hiatus in your career. It was hardly for the reasons Max Sledge did, the Robert Duvall character. But you kind of retired from playwriting for a while,
vision. Well, that's right. That's kind of a misapprehension. I really didn't retire from playwriting. I simply kind of went off into a quieter part of the world. I had a house in New Hampshire, and with my family, we lived out in the woods almost. And but actually, I was doing a great deal of writing. I was writing all the 9 plays that the first volume has just been that you talked about was published while I was there, and I wrote a couple of other plays, and then you know I began thinking about Tender Mercies while I was there. So it really was a very active time for me. I just kind of kept quiet and kept them all to myself.
Did you want to keep quiet, or had things dried up for you?
Well, nothing. I think that perhaps what had happened was that I was an interested observer in the behavior of the 60s and part of the 70s, and certainly didn't censor it, and again was interested in all that was going on, but I really didn't feel a great part of it. And felt that that was not a kind of an aesthetic an adjustment that I wanted to make. And I didn't feel that what I was working on at that time would be of particular interest to the things that were the people that were interested in the other things. So I just, you know, thought, well, I write really to do the best work I can, and if people like it or want it, that's fine. If they don't, I can't help it.
Do you feel that Tender Mercies got you, helped you to reach a new level of recognition?
Well, it certainly was, You know, it certainly did. I you know, there's always been a kind of a small base here in New York that have been, you know, kind to me and have been supportive. And I was doing, when I first came back before Tender Mercies, I went down to the HB Playwright Studio, which is on Bank Street, which Herbert Berghoff runs. And I did some plays there and kind of got my feet wet again. And then Tender Mercies certainly became, you know, I mean, more national recognition, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk more, but first we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is playwright and screenwriter Horton Foote. He's speaking to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He won Academy Awards for his screenplays for To Kill a Mockingbird and Tender Mercies. He also wrote A Trip to Bountiful. Grove Press has just published four more plays from Foote's nine-play series, The Orphan's Home Cycle. Three of the plays were produced for PBS's American Playhouse last year, and there are plans to eventually produce all nine of those plays. We'll be back in just a few seconds. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Horton Foote is my guest. You know, we were just talking about Tender Mercies. Now, that starred Robert Duvall, who you had first worked with on To Kill a Mockingbird, which you also won an Academy Award for. Now, the way I understand it, you actually suggested that Duvall be in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, really what literally happened was that he was in a play of mine at the Neighborhood Playhouse. He was studying there.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandra Meisner, who was his teacher, asked me to come down and to watch a performance of the play. And I brought Robert Mulligan, who later was to direct Mockingbird, and myself and my wife and Kim Stanley. And we went down to see this play and this extraordinary performance by this young man. So when we were casting Mockingbird, really it was my wife that suggested to me that Duvall do it, and I called up Mulligan, and he'd already seen him, so he was very much in agreement.
So you've kept in touch with Duvall over the years?
Oh, yeah, we're very close. I talked to him yesterday, as a matter of fact.
You're working on a new project together?
Yes, we are. We start shooting a play, one of the four plays in the Grove edition,
mm-hmm.
Convicts. We start that in December.
Will that be for a screen or for PBS?
For the screen.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, you won an Academy Award for To Kill a Mockingbird. I want to play just a very short scene from it. The film starred Gregory Peck, and here he is.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atticus?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much, and that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. Don't nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
Now, the screenplay you wrote was an adaptation from a novel?
Mm-hmm, by Harper Lee.
Well, how did you feel about doing an adaptation and winning an Academy Award for it? Did you like doing... You did a lot of adaptations. You adapted Faulkner for Playhouse 90.
I did a lot. Not a lot. I've done... Well, let me see. I did Faulkner. I did Harper Lee. I did Flannery O'Connor,
mm-hmm.
which is not bad. I mean, if you're going to adapt, that's the kind of things you should adapt.
Was it fulfilling work to do adaptations?
Well, it's difficult work. It's not work that I relish because it's painful. Because you know, it's first of all, there's an enormous responsibility to a fellow artist, and secondly, it's painful to try to get into somebody else's psyche, you mm-hmm. know, and to put on somebody else's skin, as it were. and to try to understand emotionally what, you know, what the work is about.
Now, some of the adaptations you did were for Playhouse 90, the television series, television...
I did two
presentations
Faulkners
back in the 1950s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now you're doing things that are being broadcast on public television's American Playhouse. Do you think the ground rules have changed in any way?
Well, actually, American Playhouse is a very progressive, wonderful. I think it's unusual. Actually, the things that I did for the American Playhouse were first released theatrically in 1918 and on Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
Courtship will be released theatrically, but that was the one that had not been seen before. But they made both of those possible. They financed them on Valentine's Day and Courtship, and without their help, I don't think we've ever made the films. And I think they more and more are helping out innovative and what I think is essentially very creative filmmaking.
Some of the plays in your 9-part cycle are set during the period of Reconstruction in the South, and in your introduction,
well, really late Reconstruction.
In the introduction to the new series of plays. You say that once, when you were at home in Texas,
yeah,
you ran into a very old man, a black man,
mm-hmm,
who told you that he had worked on your great-great-grandfather's
mm-hmm
plantation.
Mm-hmm.
What did that make you think about? How did you feel
I think I say in the introduction, I mean, it gave me a whole new perspective of what that meant. I mean, you know, I just had only had a vague kind of sense of what it meant to be a slave, and I certainly saw this human being, and I suddenly realized what a monstrous thing it must have been, and it wasn't a happy thought. I mean, it wasn't a happy experience to think that part of my family had been involved in that, but it was a reality and was something that I was grateful that I was able so young to understand the terrors of it.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think an experience like that would make some people want to leave home so that you wouldn't be seen as the great-great-grandson of a slave owner.
Well, I mean, where are you going to go? I mean, wherever you go, that's what you are, and that's what you came from. And, you know, I mean, there were also many positive things around me, and people had made different adjustments to a really tragic time, because Reconstruction was difficult for everybody, and their lives were picked up, and they didn't dwell on that. And certainly my own father was a living example of he was enormously close to black people. As a matter of fact, in one of the plays, it's about an experience of his when he lived with a black family as a boy of 12 or 13, and he was the only white person on the plantation. And he was so felt so loved and wanted that he wouldn't even go home for Christmas. So all that has a double side, you know. You just can't say, take one thing and say, well, that's ruined everything, because there are many compensating things that in the mix, so to speak.
Another of your plays, called 1918,
mm-hmm,
is about death by flu. It's during the flu epidemic,
yep,
in 1918, and death by war, World War I.
Yeah.
Did you hear a lot of stories about both when you were growing up?
Well, yes, but more about the flu than about the war, really.
Well, families lost a lot of people during
the actually, flu. The flu epidemic killed more people than the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was knew no boundaries. I mean, the people that the war couldn't get, I mean, women and children and kings and queens, the flu got. And it was a devastation. And working on it, I thought it was interesting that actually I did the play first of all down at the HB, and when Herbert saw it, he said, you know what this play is about? And I often don't know what my plays are about, so I was happy to hear. And he said, this play is about expected death and unexpected death. And I thought about it for a moment, and I said, of course it is, because the expected death was what will happen if you go to France or to the war, and the unexpected death was the flu, which just quietly came into a house, and nobody was expecting it, and took people, killed them.
Mm-hmm. You know, talking about death reminds me of a line that's very moving from A Trip to Bountiful. It's one of Geraldine Page's lines. And in explaining why she wants to go back to the home she grew up in and that she raised her children in, she says that two of her babies are buried there.
Mm.
And it made me really think about the pull that the dead exert on you.
Mm.
From the place where, you know, where your loved ones are buried.
Yeah.
Is that something you've thought about a lot?
Well, as a matter of fact, what has always haunted me is that when I was growing up, and we often, because my grandfather's death, my grandmother often went out to the cemetery, and she'd take me with her. And there in the family plot were two graves of children of hers that had died as infants. And I constantly thought about them, and it was never mentioned, never talked about. I never even saw a picture of them. But there they were, and certainly the memory of them must have lived on in all these people, you know. And it's something that is, it does have its own reality for you.
You are still living part of the time in New York now?
Yes.
Do you feel alienated in cities? You seem so drawn to
small
towns.
No, I love New York.
I
don't get to spend much time here. Actually, I'm only here now for 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'm on my way again.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing a play at the Pittsburgh Public Playhouse this fall. And I go to Richmond tomorrow on Sunday to lecture, and so I wander around a lot. But, oh, no, I think this is a great, great city, and I couldn't live in any other city in the world, really.
Okay. Before we run out of time, just tell us briefly about Convicts, the play that you're making into a movie with Robert Duvall.
Well, it's part of the 9 play cycle, and it's the second in the cycle, and it's a story, basically, of a young white boy who's living on a plantation, running a country store there for his uncle who's gone back to town. And it's a plantation worked by black convicts. And the plantation is owned by an old man of 78, who Robert Duvall will play, who is dying. And it's the relationship between this young boy and this dying old man is what the story basically is about.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Horton Foote is working on producing all 9 plays in his Orphan's Home Cycle for Public Television's American Playhouse. 4 of the plays were recently published by Grove Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Simon Frith. He's a British sociologist and rock critic who writes about the British music scene for The Village Voice. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Illinois Jacquet has spent his life playing jazz, but his tenor saxophone playing also inspired many rhythm and blues saxophonists. Coming up, Jacquet remembers some of the bands he's played with, led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, and we talk about his own big band. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Etta James, Toots Hibbert, and Willie Dixon. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Accused, starring Kelly McGillis and Jodie Foster. The movie's loosely based on the gang rape of a woman in a New England bar, a story that made headlines a few years ago. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. Republican vice presidential nominee Dan Quayle called on George Bush today, called him in Los Angeles, and urged the vice president to hit one over center field tonight in his debate with Michael Dukakis. Los Angeles is the site of the second and final debate between the two presidential nominees. Debate sponsors expect a broadcast audience in the tens of millions to see whether Bush can protect his slim lead in the polls, whether Dukakis can score a decisive blow against the Republican campaign. The U.S. trade gap was up sharply in August. The Commerce Department reports that the difference between the amount of goods the U.S. sells abroad and the value of goods imported into the country grew about 28%, or $2.7 billion. It was a much larger increase than many analysts anticipated. While the U.S. sold substantially more abroad in August than in the previous month, the level of imports into the U.S. grew even faster. A Nobel Prize winner was announced for literature today in Sweden, and as Roger Wallace reports from Stockholm, for the first time, an Arabic writer has won the award.
A 77-year-old Egyptian novelist, Nagi Mahfouz, will receive this year's $400,000 Nobel Prize for Literature. Although some of his works have been translated from Arabic into English and French, Mahfouz is hardly known in Western literary circles. But he is a folk hero in the Arab world, who has written numerous novels and short stories, many of them about the aspirations and disappointments of the poor in Cairo. Nagib Mahfouz is also a regular columnist in the Cairo daily Al-Ahram. The Nobel citation notes that Mr. Mahfouz has contributed to the formation of an Arabian narrative art that applies to all mankind. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Wallace in Stockholm.
Federal, state, and local law enforcement agents today arrested more than 120 people suspected of drug and weapons trafficking. The crackdown on the so-called Jamaican posses covered 20 states in the District of Columbia. A year ago, the first phase of an investigation into the activities of Jamaican posses was announced with the arrest of 155 suspected gang members. According to Senate testimony released today, an international banker arrested by federal authorities earlier this week said he managed a $20 million secret account for Panamanian ruler Manuel Noriega. Amjad Awan, an officer of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, said the account was used to make cash payments to Panamanian politicians and to pay travel and credit card expenses for Noriega and his family. Awan was indicted this week on charges of money laundering. His bank, which is based in Luxembourg, was charged in an indictment handed up in Tampa with money laundering. They were charged with laundering millions of dollars in narcotics profits for members of the Medellin drug cartel from Colombia. The Vatican announced today that the Shroud of Turin, long believed to be the burial cloth of Jesus, is in fact a fake and dates from the 14th century. The BBC's David Willey reports from Turin.
Radiocarbon dating tests carried out independently by laboratories in the United States, in Britain, and in Switzerland all show that the shroud was woven between 1260 and 1390 years after Christ. The ancient burial cloth, which has been kept for the past 400 years in Turin, therefore dates back only to the Middle Ages, a time where there was a strong demand for Christian relics, many of which were forged and found ready takers in abbeys, churches, and monasteries all over Europe. Cardinal Balestrero of Turin, who is the custodian of the shroud, which technically belongs to the Pope, said that as far as he was concerned, there was no problem of faith. He had always preferred to call the shroud an icon or a holy image and not a relic.
David Willey in Turin. Stock prices rose slightly on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 6 points to close at 2133 on a volume of 154 million shares. I'm Michael Richards, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. By coincidence, three veterans of three different pop genres have just released new albums. Rhythm and blues singer Etta James, reggae singer Toots Hibbert, and blues singer and guitarist Willie Dixon. They have little in common with each other, other than exerting strong influences on their respective genres. But our rock critic Ken Tucker says each has come up with engaging music at a time when they might have been written off as has-beens.
Anyone who saw the recent Chuck Berry concert film Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll knows that Etta James is alive and well as an R&B singer. Now in her 50s, she spent the past three decades bringing her big voice to bear on everything from gospel music to Randy Newman. Too often in the past, her eclecticism has been her undoing. There's been no center to her music, just an impressive leaping from style to style. Etta James's new album, 7 Year Itch, pins her down with modern soul music. And as a result, she sounds confident and artistically liberated on a song such as Breaking Up Somebody's Home.
Last night I cried so hard, I believe I caught a chill. Can't stand the vibration, oh, my heart just won't stand still.
Willie Dixon is most famous as a songwriter, not a performer. As part of Muddy Waters' band in the 40s and 50s, Dixon wrote such influential songs as I'm Your Hoochie Coochie Man and I Just Wanna Make Love to You. This new album, Hidden Charms, reminds me of those well-meaning but mediocre collaborations that used to occur in the 60s and early 70s, when earnest white rockers would help a veteran black performer cut a record in the hope of attracting the pop audience. In this case, Hidden Charms was overseen by T-Bone Burnett, a critic's darling for his own albums, and as the producer for the band Los Lobos and Roy Orbison. Burnett and Willie Dixon have chosen a series of lesser-known songs from Dixon's repertoire and have recorded them with a straightforward clarity. Unfortunately, Dixon has never been much of a singer, and as for the material, well, there are frequently good reasons why some songs by even excellent artists remain lesser-known. Still, as a modern blues album, there are a few cuts here that give contemporary whippersnappers like Robert Cray a bold challenge.
I'm going across the cross side. I'm going to cheat the cheater. I'm going to use the user and then beat the beater. You can't mess with the messer. The messer gonna mess with you.
That's Willie Dixon and Don't Mess with the Messer. The youngest member of this trio of music veterans is Toots Hibbert. Now in his 40s, this Jamaican singer has been making reggae music for over 25 years. When reggae was receiving its big commercial push in the mid-70s, Toots and his band the Maytals released one of the most powerful reggae albums ever, Funky Kingston. In America, Toots never made the kind of impact that Bob Marley and Jimmy Cliff did, but he was by far the more interesting singer and was heavily influenced by American vocalists such as Sam Cooke and Otis Redding. Toots in Memphis is a kind of concept album that organizes itself around Toots's American influences. As the title implies, Toots went to Memphis, and he made an album there that mingles soul and reggae without diluting either form.
Really love the rain against my window, bringing back freedom memories. I feel a pain when I remember how sweet it used to be when we were together. Everything was so grand, yeah. Now that we parted, if it's one shout, I got to shout, I gotta say.
That's Toots Hibbert's interpretation of the old Ann Peebles hit, I Can't Stand the Rain. All three of these albums exist outside the commercial mainstream. It would be a wild fluke if any of them became a hit, and only Toots Hibbert's record really deserves it. But then again, what's best about these albums is that they suggest lives in music that go beyond careers spent in pursuit of stardom. At this point, these singers are in it for the art as well as for the money.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's Toots Hibbert's version of Al Green's Love and Happiness from the album Toots in Memphis.
The phone, 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah. She's talking about she can make it right, yeah. Well, happiness is when you really feel good about somebody.
This is Fresh Air. Jack Kett has spent his life playing jazz, but his honking tenor saxophone solos inspired many rhythm and blues saxophonists. Jaquette's jazz career dates back to his early childhood when he sang and danced in his father's big band. In the 1940s, he played in bands led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, and played in the Jazz at the Philharmonic tours. After several decades of performing in small groups, Jaquette wanted to play in a big band again, so in 1983 he formed his own, encouraged by the success of a student big band he formed at Harvard, where he was an artist in residence. Jaquette's big band has a new album. It's his first American release in 19 years. Putting together your big band, what configuration of horns and saxophones did you know you want, and what kind of thought went into that, deciding how many of each there'd be?
Well, see, I knew what I wanted before I even organized the band. I knew how it should sound, and 5 saxophones, which Count Basie had when I was in the band, and 4 trumpets, and 3 or 4 trombones, and a full rhythm section with piano, bass, and drums. And so I knew all about what a big band should be. I like harmony. I like trombones. I like trumpets. I like saxophones. I like rhythm sections.
And good arrangements.
And the best arrangements, you know. You can do a lot. You can play soft and whisper with a big band because you can have arrangements that are so beautiful until you forget about how the size of the band.
Well, let me give an example of what you're talking about. On the new record, you have a beautiful version of More Than You Know, and it's you play beautifully on that with the band behind you.
Thank you.
ask you some things about your past. Your grandfather was a musician, and you sang and danced in your father's big band. How did your father feel about bringing you into clubs when you were just a child and exposing you to alcohol and to the club scene? Was he at all uncomfortable about that?
No, not at all. My mother and father, they loved music, and all three of my brothers played music. All my two sisters sang and danced, and I was the baby. And wherever they went, I went. And they knew that I had the talent. They knew I was going to do something. So there was no stopping me from doing anything.
After high school, you moved to Los Angeles, and you hooked up with Lionel Hampton there. You were introduced to Hampton by Nat Cole?
Yes. He jammed with the King Cole Trio, and I was as an invited guest along with him, and that's when I met him, and he heard me, and we really had a jam session that, you know, Hamp loves to play, and Nat, everybody just loves to play, and I love to play. So we played, and he called me over and asked me what I'd like to join his band. He was forming a band. So he asked me would I mind switching from the alto saxophone to the tenor saxophone.
Why did he want you to switch?
Well, he figured that the style that I was doing on the alto saxophone, if I would play it on the tenor, it would be more effective for his band. And I had to think about that. That was quite a decision to make. But if I wanted to join a named band, this was my chance, and that's why I switched.
So what was it like the first time you picked up the tenor saxophone?
Well, the first time I picked up the tenor saxophone, I sounded like Lester Young, because that's what I heard out of that horn. And I kept playing different styles of Coleman Hawkins a little here, and a little bit of Don Byers, Ben Webster, and some of the greats. You know, I always listen to the musicians, you know, the ones that really can play, you know, and they're your greatest teachers when you're learning how to play. So I could play like all the greats, but I had no style of my own, see, and you have to create something for your own if you want to last in this business. So when we got ready to record, to make my first record, now I was in trouble, see, because now what I'm going to do for myself, I had to talk to myself, and that was the trap that I was in. And Marshall Rawl, who was the first saxophone player in my Hampton band, a great musician and a great saxophonist, he knew that I could play like everybody. And just as I got up to go to the mic, he whispered in my ear, say, "Go for yourself." I said, "Go for myself." And as I was walking up to the microphone, that's when I created this solo on Flying Home, May the 26th, 1942, on Decca Records.
Age 19 when you made that record.
Yes.
How did your recording of Flying Home change your life? People started noticing you.
Well, no one could follow that song when we played. None of the acts could come on behind that. The show was over every night. I remember when engagement we played at the Golden Gate Theater, and the people got so carried away with this solo until you could see the balcony about to cave in from the stage. You could see it. It created excitement that you could never believe. You'd have to be there and be playing it to realize what was happening. And it was all me. And it just changed my whole life into knowing and gave me the confidence that I had to take care of myself, and I had to really continue to do things in music that I'd never believed that I could do.
You've played with a lot of great band leaders. You've played with Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, with Cab Calloway. You grew up playing with your father. What kind of band leader are you? And have you taken any of your cues from the band leaders who you've played with?
Yes. Well, in my father's band, the dissonant was there. And I learned that from him, that timing was very essential, that without time, without making time, you're going to play like that. And when I joined the Hampton Band, I learned about the excitement, that the showmanship, that Hampton is a great showman along with his talent. And when I joined the Cavs Band, I learned how to discipline yourself to dress. Cap was one of the best dressed leaders that you could want to see on stage. He had special clothes and special shoes, and it was everything out there. And I learned from that. When I joined the Count Basie Band, I learned the discipline of calling a set, programming your music, take a big band and make it whisper, so when you came to the excitement, it would be an explosion of music. So I mold all that into my being in front of my big band, and I am so happy to be in front of this band. I've never been as happy as I am now.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Illinois Jacquette's new big band album, Jacquette's Got It, is on Atlantic Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What's coming up?
Well, we have news about the trade figures, the increased trade deficit, and also we look ahead to today's debate and a report about a speech by Mikhail Gorbachev about agriculture, in which the new Politburo member in charge of agriculture, Igor Ligachev, wasn't there, which is an interesting twist. Also, but looking at our rundown for today, this is a real free association program. We have an item being written by our producer, Art Silverman. We talk to Marshall Goldman, Merle Goldman, Barry Goldwater, and we hear from Daniel Pinkwater.
What do you think of when I say the word spider? Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A gang rape in a New Bedford, Massachusetts bar a few years ago made national headlines. The Accused is a new film loosely based on that incident and the trial that followed. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Ever since Jagged Edge caught on at the box office, Hollywood has been eager to churn out courtroom dramas, which in a way is a pity. Most directors don't understand what makes a good courtroom drama. They think that if the case fascinates, the movie will too. Actually, the details of the case scarcely matter. A courtroom drama becomes exciting only when its characters and the atmosphere around them are exciting. All of this is by way of telling you that The Accused is a very doggy movie about a very interesting case. Although the film has been set in the state of Washington, and the filmmakers have very purposefully changed names and details, the movie's premise will be familiar to anyone who remembers the horrific incident that took place in New Bedford, Massachusetts a few years ago. There in a rowdy bar, a young and admittedly rowdy woman was gang-raped while onlookers cheered and clapped. In The Accused, Kelly McGillis plays the assistant DA who takes on the case, and Jodie Foster is the rape victim. And it's only a matter of time before they have the conversation that all assistant DAs and all rape victims now have in every TV movie you've ever seen about the subject.
How are you dressed? What's that supposed to mean? It means were you dressed provocatively? Showing a lot of cleavage, see-through blouse. Did you put on a show? What the hell are you talking about? You saw me at the hospital. What, you think I asked for that? Have you ever made love to more than one man at a time? What kind of question is that? You're a witness. And it's the defense's job to show the jury that you're a rotten witness because you've got a rotten character.
Soon things seem on the verge of resolution. Without consulting her client for some reason, McGillis cuts a deal. There will be no trial. Foster won't have to testify, and the rapist will go to jail on lesser charges. Then McGillis gets an attack of guilt. Foster, who wanted to take the stand, still feels unavenged, and McGillis decides she'll take the bystanders to court, the ones who clapped and cheered, on the grounds of criminal solicitation. By egging on the criminals, they helped cause the crime. Now the movie's in a quandary. It has to get us rooting to put three men behind bars for 5 years for the crime of clapping and cheering. Fortunately for the director, Jonathan Kaplan, and the screenwriter, Tom Topor, this isn't hard to accomplish. You just take one of those bystanders and turn him into the sleaziest, scummiest miscreant since The Creature from the Black Lagoon. After a little of that, the audience wouldn't mind seeing him put away for littering. I'm not saying that the clappers and cheerers were not guilty of some crime deserving of some punishment, but the accused steamrolls over the thorny issues it raises, and any thoughtful response we might have is flattened in the dust. McGillis gives a curiously icy, uninflected performance, and Foster's character is supposed to seem all the more sympathetic because she's so dishwater dull. The movie gives her a single pitiable shtick, a penchant for astrology, and then leaves her floundering. Fortunately, Jodie Foster wouldn't know how to flounder if you dumped her in the Mariana Trench. She's made a habit lately of delivering terrific performances in terrible movies. Five Corners, Siesta, and Stealing Home come to mind. And she does it again here. Through the thicket of clichés the accused cultivates around her, you can still perceive Foster at work, building out of nothing a character who's sexy, courageous, and movingly desolate.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Octavio Paz is Mexico's preeminent poet, one of its leading intellectuals, and a former diplomat. On the next Fresh Air, he discusses history, revolution, and surrealism and their influence on his life's work. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone gives her take on Gorillas in the Mist, and a couple of old swing tunes with a modern flavor as New Orleans pianist and composer Harry Connick Jr. joins Fresh Air as our performer in residence. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistance from Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.